the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. We're going to be talking today about a phenomenon that has recently emerged in the media, and it must be telling us something. First, an article in the Los Angeles Times, then two in the New York Times. Over the weekend, a massive article in the Washington Post magazine, all about one thing. And that is a particular understanding of what's going on in the culture of death with what is called selective reduction. And this refers to the killing, the strategic killing of certain fetuses in a multiple pregnancy, supposedly in order to allow the remaining fetuses to thrive without some of the complications that would come from multiple birth below or above the level of twin. But the bigger issue here is that there is obviously a troubled conscience on the part of so many in the medical community over now how this is done, why it is done. We're going to be talking today about this, and I would refer you right now to my article, and I don't say this casually. I believe this is one of the most important things I've written in a very long time, posted last night. The article is entitled The Revenge of Conscience, and we're going to be talking about this today. You can go even right now to the website at albertmohler.com, look at the article right on the top entitled The Revenge of Conscience. You can go from my article to the article at the Washington Post magazine from yesterday, and we'll get to that conversation in just a few moments. This is one of the most cutting-edge issues in biotechnology, reproductive ethics, and it tells us a great deal, a very great deal, a frighteningly great deal about where we are as a society and as a culture. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. My title for this article, The Revenge of Conscience, is taken from a philosopher at the University of Texas known as Jay Budachevsky. Professor Budachevsky makes a very important point, and that is that conscience can be suppressed, but it will bounce back. And I think that has to be what explains right now this flurry of articles. I mean, you're talking about the time span of barely a week and having major articles in the three perhaps most influential newspapers in America, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. We'll be talking about this in just a few moments. It ought to tell us something. And what it tells us is both frightening and illuminating. Lots of issues in the news, of course, lots of conversation going on in this country with the presidential campaign heating up and all the rest, but there are some family issues that are also front page issues for America. USA Today, the lead, the headline today, Generation Gap, the answer to their question is about $200,000. In other words, they're saying that the median net worth of people 55 to 64 has climbed to nearly $250,000, while it has dropped to about $50,000 for those in their late 30s. Something is going on here. And one of the big questions is, what has happened? The biggest income divide in America, or wealth divide right now, is not between races. It's not between even those with different educational status. It's between generations. The generation of those who are 55 and older tend, by and large, to be far more comfortable than those younger. And that in itself is something of a reversal in terms of American economic history. For so many decades, and even longer, the presumption was that the younger you are, the more wealth you are producing, the more cash you have at your disposal, it's after retirement that things get tight. That's not the way it is right now, not for many Americans. The disparity is between those 55 and older and those now in their mid-40s, late-30s, and younger. USA Today is asking the big question, how did this happen? And there is an interesting answer to this question. That younger generation is the first generation in American history to be saddled with such massive educational debt. A large number of the people in that generation are leaving college, law school, medical school, even just an undergraduate education with $60,000 to $80,000 of debt. And beyond that, they become addicted to consumer debt. And so very quickly, upon even graduating from college or graduate school, they add to their educational debt with massive consumer debt. And by the time all of this is taken into account, they're not worth much, not financially. Their total cash value in terms of debts and liabilities over against assets is about $50,000. That's frighteningly low in this economy. This is one of those stories that tells us a great deal of what we have done to our own young people and to younger generations in creating this culture of debt. Because when you get in this kind of debt at that age, it's very hard to crawl out of it. Because if you are in your late 30s and you're already in debt and you still owe several thousand dollars from your own educational debt, here's the bad news. Your kids are just getting ready to go to college. You're about to find yourself in even greater debt, or you just download this all the more to lower generations, and your kids end up with even higher educational debt. That's something to look at here. Of course, there are a lot of considerations for Christians in terms of the culture of debt, and there are those who would say, well, education is the right thing to borrow money for if you're going to have to borrow money. But the long-term consequences of this are often not taken into account. This is one of the things when I'm asked for counsel for young people, I say, look, higher education is not uniformly out of reach. You do not have to spend yourself into oblivion and into debt for higher education. There are options out there, but there are an awful lot of people who think that they have to go to this school or that school. They have to have this kind of degree from this particular institution without counting the cost. Other issues in the news include USA Today, again, asking the question. Now, here's an interesting headline for a secular newspaper. What is a real Christian? The article's by Dan Gilgoff, and he is writing this in light of the 2008 presidential field. He begins his article this way, placing strong in polls of Republican voters and encouraged to run by some leading party activists, actor and former Senator Fred Thompson has emerged as the biggest X factor of the 2008 presidential race. As he publicly weighs a White House bid, the calculus behind a Thompson run is clear. He could win the nomination by riding the support of the Republican Party's conservative base, which continues to harbor doubts over the three GOP presidential frontrunners. But, the article goes on to say, there's a wrinkle in that strategy, because some persons are asking whether or not Fred Thompson is a Christian. Now listen to this paragraph. But the fact that neither Thompson nor any of his top-tier Republican presidential candidates claims to be a born-again Christian raises broader questions in the race for a GOP nomination. One is, simply, who do evangelicals consider to be a Christian? Another is whether a candidate being considered Christian is a prerequisite to winning evangelical support. Now, I am not so interested in the political calculation here. I'm interested in the fact that USA Today has written an article with a headline, a question, what is a real Christian? Now, this answer is going to have to come from someone, and as you would imagine, in an article like this, the reporter went to several sources. One of them was Mark Knoll at the University of Notre Dame, formerly for many years at Wheaton College. He said, and I quote, evangelicals have always had a pretty narrow understanding of who is a Christian in the proper sense of the term. Catholics and most Lutherans and Episcopalians would say that anyone who has been baptized is a Christian. But most evangelicals would not agree. They see baptism as an initiation ceremony that may or may not indicate the presence of true faith. End quote. Now, that's both true and a bit confusing. And I'm not suggesting that Mark Knoll was necessarily confusing, because when you look at a news story like this, you're not sure exactly how any source would have concluded a sentence. You know how the reporter and the editor decided to use the material. I'd have to go on and say that the big issue is really not baptism. It's faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you shall be saved. There's a very easy, simple New Testament formula. Now, thankfully, there was another source in this, and this is Russell Moore, my colleague, dean of the School of Theology here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and guest host of this program. He said this. He said, it's a question of the heart. Has someone turned away from his own works to put his trust in Jesus Christ, and does he believe in the Jesus that the Bible portrays? If so, that person has been born again. End quote. Well, Dr. Moore is exactly right. It comes down to a matter of personal belief, personal faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. But it's very interesting now to look at the fact that it was in the 1976 presidential campaign that Newsweek magazine asked a very similar question in its cover story. Many in the news media were asking the question back then, 1976, that's 31 years ago, they were asking the question, what does it mean to be a Christian? Of course, then it was the candidacy of Jimmy Carter and the language that Americans were learning, some in the mainstream media, the language being born again. Perhaps what this article in USA Today tells us is that America has to talk about these things over and over again. And in this secular age, there are a good many people who have no clue what Christianity really is. I have to tell you, though, as a theologian and churchman, my bigger concern is there are an awful lot of people in churches who seem not to know what a real Christian is. As a matter of fact, there are some people who would resist the question. They would consider it rude, and they would consider it odd that anyone would ask this question. Why anyone who considers himself a Christian must be a Christian? But you know, the Bible very clearly tells us that there are identifying marks of a Christian, and the true Christian is the one who has placed his or her faith and trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. These clarifying moments every once in a while tell us who we are as a people. The church needs to remind itself of who we are as a church. And a flurry of stories like these on what is now euphemistically called selective reduction, the targeting of certain fetuses for killing, tells us a great deal of who we are as a culture. We'll be back to talk about that in just a moment. The phone number 877-893-8255, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program. I didn't start working on it until very late last night. Then I wrote 2,000 words, an article posted at my website overnight entitled The Revenge of Conscience. I went back to an article that I had read earlier in the weekend, but frankly didn't really want to think about. It's an article in the Washington Post magazine, and the article itself is simply one of the most chilling things I have ever read because it gets right to the heart of where we are as a culture, in the culture of death. It gets right to the heart of where we are as a people and accommodating ourselves to the most grotesque and murderous forms of fetal death, intentional strategic fetal death, and the calculation of all of this. Now, I mentioned there's been a flurry of articles. I guess it was about 2 weeks ago that in the Los Angeles Times there was this article by a man talking about how he and his wife had come to make the decision and then have the experience of selective reduction. And you may remember that this was a multiple pregnancy, as I recall, two girls and two boys, and they targeted the two boys because they said that they were more likely to have genetic problems than the girls simply because they were boys. And so in a very cold and calculating way in that article, the man just spoke of this. And, you know, the language that he used was chilling, I think, to Americans because he spoke without any sense of loss in these two boys in the fetus being killed. The man's name was Dan Neal. He wrote just this way. He said, "We don't feel guilty. We don't feel ashamed. We're not even really sad because terminating these fetuses at 15 weeks gestation was a medical imperative. This has been a white-knuckle pregnancy from day one, and had it gone on as it was going, Tina's health would have been in jeopardy, according to her doctor. The fact is, multiple pregnancies are high risk, and they can go bad very suddenly. I wasn't going to allow that. Though the fires of hell might beckon." Now, that's quite a statement right there. And, of course, it slides by the big moral decision which he and his wife had made, and that is to use in vitro fertilization technology with the transfer of multiple embryos, knowing that they were all likely to start growing in her womb. They avoid taking any moral responsibility for creating this in the first place, knowing that the very technology and practice they were using is leading to the problem they now say is an imperative, to kill two of the babies in order that the other two might more successfully thrive. That was in the Los Angeles Times. The date of that article was May 6, 2007. Then, just over the last couple of weeks in the New York Times, two articles. The first article came out dealing with Down syndrome babies and got clearly to the fact, now attested by the New York Times, that 90% of fetuses diagnosed with Down syndrome are now aborted. 90%, that's 9 out of 10. The article was by Amy Harmon. She came back just a couple of days later with a second article, also in the New York Times, this one having to do with the fact that genetic testing, not only for Down syndrome, but for any number of genetic traits or abnormalities, is now leading to the option of abortion, and it's an option that is increasingly being taken. The most chilling aspect of that article was that you had sources, for instance, from Planned Parenthood and from reproductive ethicists saying that they could draw no clear line between what was and was not a legitimate ground for the abortion of a fetus. And the bottom line is, they said, "We don't think we're in a position ever to draw that line. If a woman says that she wants to abort this fetus because it's a boy and she wants a girl, or this one because it's a girl and she wants a boy, if she wants blonde hair and blue eyes, if she wants high athletic ability or high intelligence, who are we to say that it's wrong to abort a fetus on any of those criteria?" But then, the most chilling of all comes this weekend in the Washington Post magazine. And, you know, these magazine inserts in the major newspapers often have some of the most fascinating content. Certainly it was the case in this article, Liza Mundy, who's the author of the book Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World, takes us into the practice of Dr. Evans, in this case, a doctor in Manhattan. And this particular Dr. Mark Evans is in the practice of selective reduction. He pioneered the technology and the procedure whereby it is done. And Liza Mundy takes us not only into his office, but into the heart of the issue. Now, I want to warn you that what you're going to be hearing on this program today is some of the hardest material I've ever read or exposed my listeners to. And yet I dare not do it. Here's how she begins the article. She says selective reduction is one of the most unpleasant facts of fertility medicine, which has helped hundreds of thousands of couples have children, but has also produced a sharp rise in high-risk multiple pregnancies. There's no way to know how many pregnancies achieved by fertility treatment start out as triplets or quadruplets and are quietly reduced to something more manageable. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which publishes an annual report on fertility clinic outcomes, does not include selective reduction figures because of the reluctance to report them. The industry doesn't report them either. This is a very sensitive topic, says David Granger, president of the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, the membership group for IVF clinics. It's sensitive personally for patients, but also politically for doctors. If you want to know why, just read this article. It will tell you everything you need to know. Dr. Evans tells us that his goal is the delivery of a healthy baby, or of healthy babies as twins. Mundy summarizes the problem this way. She says, quote, in some cases, this can be achieved by treating a fetus in utero. In some cases, it is achieved by sacrificing a fetus in utero. It was Dr. Evans who developed the technique of inserting a tiny needle into the unborn child and then injecting potassium chloride into the fetal heart, killing the baby. He does so, he explains, because multiple pregnancies are more dangerous than pregnancies involving a single baby or twins. Dr. Evans says he's attempted to define his own set of what he calls guiding principles in terms of the ethics of his practice. At first, he refused to take gender into consideration. Now he does so. He allows couples to choose to carry one boy fetus and one girl fetus while killing the others. He also at first refused to reduce pregnancies from twins to single babies because he admits that there is no increased danger to the fetus when it has a twin. But he got over that too. He changed his policy. He now allows couples who want just a single child to reduce to one. Now, very clearly, Dr. Evans' guiding principles are more like sliding principles. He's making up his morality as he goes along. Liza Mundy introduces readers of her article to three different women seeking reductions from Dr. Evans. The first is a woman in her 30s. Let me read to you from the report. She and her husband have decided to go through the IVF procedure. Now she is preparing to reduce the babies from 3 to 2. Liza Mundy reports this. The fetuses were moving and waving their limbs. This is on sonogram, imaging technology. Approaching 12 weeks of gestation, they were clearly human. At that big-headed, could-be-an-alien, but definitely not a kitten stage of development. Evans has found this to be the best window of time in which to perform a reduction. Waiting that long provides time to see whether the pregnancy might reduce itself naturally through miscarriage and lets the fetuses develop to the point where genetic testing can be done to see which are chromosomally normal. Greenbaum, that's his assistant, periodically magnified one fetus and brought it into focus. She would then freeze the frame and do two things. Measure the fetus to assess their growth and see if anyone is lagging, and take a nuchal translucency test, measuring the fluid behind each fetus's neck. An excess of nuchal fluid suggests a possible problem, Down syndrome, for example. They're all measuring at 11 weeks and 6 days, Greenbaum says. That's right, the woman said wonderingly. It's 12 weeks tomorrow. So far, there was nothing anomalous about any of the fetuses. Greenbaum turned the screen toward the patient. That's the little heartbeat, she said, pointing to the area where a tiny organ was clearly pulsating. And there are the little hands. There's the head, the body. I can really see it, the patient cried. I can see the fingers. Okay, she said, gesturing for the screen to be turned away. She began sobbing. There were no tissues in the room, so her husband gave her a paper towel, which she crumpled onto her face. The patient spent the rest of the procedure with her hospital gown over her face so that she would not see any more of what was happening. Just one of three patients covered in this story. The article that I wrote is entitled The Revenge of Conscience, because conscience will have its revenge. This woman can hide under her hospital gown, but she can't hide from the truth. The phone number is 877-893-8255, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
It seems that even the secular conscience is becoming more and more troubled by the knowledge that there is a carnage going on in America's wombs, especially given the advent of new reproductive technologies, with the fact that one of the side effects of so many of these are multiple pregnancies. There is now the sophisticated targeting of fetuses in the womb for what is euphemistically called reduction. A euphemism, you know, is a word that is used when you don't want to say what it is. Medically, they want to call these selective reductions, but it's feticide. It is abortion. It's the killing of an unborn baby, an unborn child in the womb, simply because its presence supposedly threatens the thriving of the others. What's truly frightening about this is that it is selective. The word selective reduction, that phrase, both words are important. And when it's selective, that means that some of these babies are targeted. The article by Liza Monday in yesterday's edition of the Washington Post magazine tells us exactly how some of this targeting is being done. The second example she gives is of a mother who is a lesbian, a pregnant woman who comes in with her lesbian partner. And they determine to reduce, that is, to kill at least one fetus on the basis of the fact that it's female, because they decide they want to raise a boy in this case because they think that, now get this, adolescent boys have less stress with their mothers than adolescent girls. That's the decision-making process. A woman, the second patient of the three that is actually mentioned sequentially in the article, but the third of my concern, is a woman who came from Puerto Rico. And it turns out that she is carrying three girls. She wants two girls, so they try to go through the process of deciding which of the fetuses needs to be targeted. The clinical and cold nature of the reporting here is, I think, unprecedented in the mass media today. Now listen to this. This is a report of how it is done. Destroying a fetus requires three hands, one to hold the ultrasound transducer on the patient's belly, one to inject the needle and maneuver it into a position near the fetal heart, another to draw out the metal rod at the core of the needle and replace it with the vial of potassium chloride. Evans, that's the doctor, who is left-handed, did all these things at various times, tools close together as he worked over his patient's belly. At points, Greenbaum, that's his assistant, assisted by holding the vial until he needed it, holding the transducer and coaching him into position, watching him on the screen and issuing directions. Evans worked for a while as he was trying to get the needle into the right spot. "I'm not in," he said at one point tensely. Then he pinned fetus C with the needle and pushed the plunger to release the chemical. The fetus, which had been indolating and waving, went still. It would remain in the womb while the other fetuses grew and developed. Elsewhere in the article, Liza Mundy reports it this way. This is the patient who is Emma. Evans prepared two syringes, swabbed Emma with the antiseptic, put the square-holed napkin on her stomach. Then he plunged one of the needles into Emma's belly and began to work his way into position. He injected the potassium chloride, and fetus B, the first fetus to go, went still. "There's no activity there," he said, scrutinizing the screen. B was lying lengthwise in its little honeycomb chamber, no longer there and yet still there. It was impossible not to find the site affecting. Here was a life that one minute was going to happen, and now, because of its location, wasn't. One minute, B was a fetus with a future stretching out before it, childhood, college, children, grandchildren, maybe. The next minute, that future had been deleted. Well, there's the kind of language, and by the way, this Dr. Evans, the doctor who's the focus of the article, uses language that goes beyond that. He actually speaks of the difficulty of chasing the fetuses in the womb. He also calls them kids. He can't help it. He even speaks of the danger, given the size of these fetuses, of blowing them off with the needle when he's trying to insert the needle into their heart in order to kill them with potassium chloride. The title of my article is The Revenge of Conscience. Jay Buduchevsky is exactly right, philosopher at the University of Texas. He says, look, revenge is the right word because conscience always comes back. We can try to deny it. He goes on to say that the moral knowledge we lack is not a moral knowledge we don't know, it's a moral knowledge we don't want to admit. And that is certainly the case, especially the case, when we look at the horror of what's going on in American hospitals, doctors' offices, and fertility clinics with this practice of selective reduction. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The big question is this: what does this say about us as a people? What does this tell us about moral knowledge? What does it tell us about the revenge of conscience? It tells us something that the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, and the Washington Post have decided they have to talk about this out of the blue. A flurry of articles about this, because even those who consider themselves most ardently pro-abortion are having a hard time explaining this one. It's time for us to talk about it. The phone number 877-893-8255, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Posted my article, The Revenge of Conscience, overnight, and I have been I've been inundated with emails and other links to the article response, just because so many people have basically been unaware of what's been going on. And this, to me, is one of the most frightening dimensions of all of this. There are thousands, millions of people out there who would be up in arms about this, except they just don't think about it. They have no clue what goes on behind the closed doors of many of these clinics and medical schools and hospitals. They just have they don't have a clue. If they did know, they would want to do something about it. Jay Budachevsky is exactly right. The most important moral knowledge isn't something we don't know. It's something we don't want to know. It's something we don't want to admit. And what, of course, all of these and these particular news stories don't want to admit is that these are human beings. The very descriptions that Liza Mundy uses make that clear. And the reality is, that's why these stories appeared in the first place. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Conscience will have its revenge. You can have your say by calling 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Brenda, listening on WHCB in Jonesville, Virginia. Go ahead, Brenda.
Hi, I was just calling in to comment about the selective reduction. 8 years ago, my husband and I found out that we were having triplets, and shortly into the pregnancy, discovered that one of the children had medical issues, and we were given the option of selective reduction at that point, but it just was not an option for us. We were given three children, and we've been blessed with three beautiful children.
Well, God bless you, Brenda. I appreciate that word. Let me just ask you, if you would just share with us, did you feel any pressure from your doctor to take this route of selective reduction? Because what we're hearing in a lot of these news stories is that doctors are saying this is just the accepted medical practice, and there's a lot of pressure put on parents to do this.
In our particular case, I don't feel like we had a lot of pressure because we were very firm that it was not an option for us.
Well, that's a good thing, and I certainly appreciate your very strong conviction on the issue, and I could only wish that other mothers and other parents had the same convictions, because every one of the parents, every one of the mothers that is mentioned in this article by Liza Mundy appears to want the children to be born, but not enough that they would buck the doctor's advice, not enough that they would refuse to go along with a selective reduction. Brenda, thank you so much, and thank you for that testimony, and God bless you and your three children, the triplets. Phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. When I mention the revenge of conscience, I mean that culturally, given society at large, but I also mean it personally. Liza Mundy also refers to the fact that a good many of these women who undergo selective reduction then have great trouble about it. This comes back. A source cited by Mundy explained, and I quote here, that psychoanalytic interviews with women who underwent selective reduction describe severe bereavement reactions, including ambivalence, guilt, and a sense of narcissistic injury, all of which increase the complexity of their attachment to the remaining babies, end quote. Now, that again is the kind of psychotherapeutic language that says as much by what it doesn't say than by what it does. This kind of language, for instance, about, you know, increasing the complexity of their attachment to the remaining babies, that means that one day these kids are going to find out they had siblings. One day they're going to find out that they had shared the womb with brothers and sisters who were murdered in order that they would be alive. The psychological complexities of this for the mom are one thing. What about the psychological complexities of this for a child who finds out that he was spared when a brother or sister was killed in order that he would come to life. Several of these mothers are saying that when they come to know their children, the ones that survive and are born, and they come to know their personalities, they begin to feel guilt, knowing that there should be others here at this table, there should be others in this family. And it's another reminder to us again, conscience will have its revenge. We can try to deny that there's anything wrong with this, and this society does. You can try to cloak it as best medical practice. And that's one of the most insidious things going on here, is that the development of the in vitro fertilization has led to at least two huge moral crises. One is the existence of hundreds of thousands of fertilized human embryos now frozen that will never be transferred into a mother's womb. That's one crisis. The second crisis is when multiple pregnancies occur, and that is common. And the reason, by the way, that it is common is that in order to save money, and money's a huge part of this, multiple embryos are transferred into the womb to increase the likelihood that at least some of them will thrive and begin to grow in gestation. So we have these two huge crises, and most Americans are unaware of it, and they think of in vitro fertilization or the so-called test tube baby as basically just a good thing, a wonderful thing. Just like we developed antibiotics and antiseptics and anesthesia, now we've developed a new way of increasing the opportunity for people to have babies. It must be a good thing. Years ago, in a book on in vitro fertilization, there were yes and no chapters, and I was asked to write the no chapter, and I did. It's probably the shortest title in any chapter I've ever written. No. Because the moral complexities, I believe, of in vitro fertilization severely, tremendously outweigh the benefit. At the very least, Christian parents would have to be absolutely committed to transfer all fertilized embryos and to reduce none. But that's going to run against the prevailing best practices in the medical profession. It's going to run against the policies of so many of these clinics, and it's going to run against the tide of the larger culture. Let's go to Angela calling from Salem, Oregon, listening on KCCS. Go ahead, Angela.
Yeah, years ago, I had to take fertility drugs to conceive my son, and my doctor, my fertility specialist, had me go in daily for blood work and ultrasounds to make sure that I didn't have more than 3 eggs fertilized, and he called selective reduction schizophrenic for families, for parents that are trying to have children to then have to choose to abort the children.
So, in other words, this doctor said that he did not go along with the logic of selective reduction.
No, and this was 10 years ago, and the technology is there to not have these multiple births.
Yeah, and Angela, that's a very good point. And of course, the technology is there in the case of almost all these patients. In fact, all 3 of the patients covered in Liza Mundy's article in the Washington Post magazine, the technology is there because these embryos were intentionally transferred into the womb. So obviously, if they had just transferred 2 embryos, there could have been no more than two babies growing in the womb. Folks, we're talking here about a crisis of major proportions, and I now must ask the question, have we as a society reached the point of no moral return? This article forces us to face the fact that we've become a society that considers selective reduction just a part of what is necessary given the power of new reproductive technologies. We will become killers, even as we become the givers of life. A needle is inserted into one baby in order to kill, another needle and yet another baby in order to save. We can try to call it selective reduction, but we know in our hearts exactly what it is. The very essence of sin is the ambition to be as God. I can't think of a more chilling example of that basic instinct than this. I'll be right back. You don't have to be a keen observer of the culture to know that there is increased hostility against Christianity in the larger culture. Tomorrow on this program, we're going to be taking a look at Christopher Hitchens' new book entitled God is Not Great. And as you can tell from the title, he is not an affirming voice for Christianity. As a matter of fact, he suggests that belief in God is one of the most dangerous things, the most grievous ills ever to befall humanity. He himself is a rather grotesque figure, but given his influence in the media, we're going to be looking at this book, and once again, it's taking off, and it'll be on the bestseller list, along with books by Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, and all the rest. Already, he's being counted as one of the 4 horsemen of modern atheistic secularism. We're going to be talking about that book tomorrow, but we're also going to be thinking about the larger issue of hostility towards Christianity. I got a wake-up call on that this past week. when I published my article on the death of Dr. Jerry Falwell at the Washington Post and Newsweek at the On Faith column, I was unprepared for the fact that as of now, as of this minute, there are 497 responses to my article posted at the Washington Post. That's right, almost 500. And most of them not only negative, but almost unbelievably bitter and ugly, and most of them not even something I could repeat on this program. Now, a lot of people look at that and say, well, that was Jerry Falwell. That doesn't necessarily mean that that same kind of attack would be directed at all Christians. Let me ask you the question. How much unlike Jerry Falwell would you have to be to avoid that kind of controversy? Because an awful lot of what you'll see in these comments is that they are directed to Dr. Falwell, not for anything that he said that was outside the ordinary, not for any controversy, but for his convictions on things like salvation and homosexuality and abortion. Just how far from those things are you willing to run in order to avoid that kind of controversy? Perhaps we need to ask Charlie Gibson of ABC News. The Washington Post reports, and I read, after word arrived Tuesday afternoon that Jerry Falwell had suffered a fatal heart attack, Charlie Gibson was determined not to lead his newscast with the preacher's death. Quote, it lends importance to a figure whose legacy contained a lot of negatives and a lot of positives, says the ABC anchor. It venerates the subject to an extent that I didn't think belonged there. He was a controversial figure, end quote. Now, that is a fascinating statement to be made by the anchor of ABC News, who says that he doesn't lead with the story, admitting that it's news, because he said the figure is controversial. The Weekly Standard goes at him with full force, asking the question, you know, by what kind of standard, then, is he willing to apply that to other people? Of whom could it not be said? His legacy contained a lot of positives and a lot of negatives. Charlie Gibson's going to have a hard time coming up with a lead for his news if he's going to avoid persons with both positives and negatives. In reality, we all know what that tells us. He didn't want to lead the news with the report of Dr. Falwell's death. It'll be up to him to explain better why not. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation.
And be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.